It is February 27, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we're going to do geek news in the first half, and of course in the second half, we're going to take your calls with questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. The geeks today are Miles Elam. He's a slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, Lyle.
My name's Lyle Troxell. I work for the University of California, Santa Cruz, supporting high-tech art. And we also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe's a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, sometimes. Morning.
So what's the sad news?
Well, I figured we should probably take a few moments to pay respects to our honored dead. The latest to join those ranks is Internet Explorer 6, according
to... Wait, the browser?
Yes. Yes,
from
the
Microsoft.
Web browser. Yeah, our beloved Internet Explorer 6.
We have the same wrong kind of music here, man. This is a happy occasion.
No, this is Internet Explorer 6, you know? Like, we've come to love, you know, the box model hacks and the, all of the CSS that we've had to...
All those extra CSS files.
Yeah, the HTML IE-specific comments that we've had to implement in all of our websites to make
Ding
them display.
Ding dong, the witch is dead, the wicked witch, the witch is dead. Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead.
So,
okay,
yeah.
So Internet Explorer is this horrible browser that we've all been fighting with for years. Get rid of it. And why is it dead? Did Microsoft stop supporting it?
No. Of course, they would never do that.
They do recommend upgrading to 7 or 8. I mean, there's two versions after IE6.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. God forbid anyone's still on 5.5. I mean, oof. But yeah, Internet Explorer 6 is... as of March, February, March, yeah, March 1st, I think, is not going to be supported. Google's not going to be supporting it in a lot of its sites. Google Docs,
March 13th.
Google sites, March 13th. Sorry,
Friday.
There actually, I think there are two dates: March 13th and March 1st for various different Google products. And so, this group, the All10 Computer Group in Denver, has decided to hold an official event, a funeral for Internet Explorer 6. And if you want to, nice. If any of you listeners are in Denver right now or will be on March 4th, 2010, 7 p.m., then it'll be on 15th Street in Denver, Colorado, and you can RSVP at ie6funeral.com.
Nice.
And I believe that should probably be free.
Let me give you some clarity on everybody. For everybody's, we talk about using a different browser rather than Internet Explorer. If we want to be more clear about that, we'd say don't use Internet Explorer 6. Don't use a younger Internet Explorer than Internet Explorer 7. Because this is not a Microsoft bashing thing at all. That browser just doesn't have the feature set that rich browsers have right now. Like, the reason we can do the amazing things in the Web 2.0 world is not because of Internet Explorer 6. It's because people have been very smart and figured out how to hack around the problems in Internet Explorer 6. And I think I've been kind of accepting 6 not being supported for a while. I don't think I support it in new websites that I create at this point. Yeah.
Of course, it really depends on who you're targeting your websites for. If you're targeting it for governmental agencies, then, you know, maybe you do want to support IE6 because a lot of them have beige boxes which only have IE6 on them, and they don't have it updated because the IT infrastructure has to do it for them.
Wait, did you just say government should have the most insecure browser on the
planet? I didn't say they should. I said that they may. I'm saying that if you want to design a site that's targeting those people, then you want the site to be able to display. I do want to read a brief poem that someone wrote in the comments.
Before you
in
did
a
that,
second,
Don just whispered that hospitals mostly use Internet Explorer 6.
Oh, no.
And not just that, exchange over the web.
Exchange content over the web?
No.
Oh,
Microsoft Exchange,
for email?
The mail.
Over the web.
Over the web. So ActiveX controls, you know, comm objects to the actual client.
This is a large topic, but just suffice to say, everyone in this room doesn't want you using Internet Explorer 6. If you are, please upgrade your browser.
Yeah.
We suggest using an open source solution, and there's quite a few out there. Chrome is not a bad browser. Don't use it on a Mac because it doesn't support Flash.
Yeah, it does.
Well, not without hacking. I can't get Flash to run on my
machine.
But it's because I have a 64-bit.
Not noticed the lack of Flash in my Chrome browser.
Can't install it on my machine. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You sure that's not a you-specific issue?
No. Snow Leopard Internet with a 64-bit operating system.
Maybe I just haven't...
Oh, no. Flash doesn't have a 64-bit plugin. That's the issue.
It does.
It has a 32-bit plugin. They have a beta of a 64-bit plugin, but apparently
maybe
it still
I'm
has
wrong
some
on
issues.
That.
Beta
I'll,
has issues. And I'll... so I'm in Safari and Firefox. I'm not running 64-bit. So the other browser to use would be Firefox. You actually...
I use OmniWeb, actually.
OmniWeb?
OmniWeb is also a WebKit-based browser, so it renders just like a lot like Safari.
Like Safari,
and it's a fantastic, fantastic, stable, fast, clean web browser. So,
and
it's also
or
free.
If you're on a Windows environment and you really want to be on a Windows, please get Internet Explorer 7 or 8 and not Internet Explorer 6.
Yeah.
But moving on, what's the poem? And then
oh,
we'll move
yeah.
On from
so this is one of the commenters at the funeral site. Daniel Noe wrote... Oh, IE6, such a hard person to please. Always thought he was more exclamation point important than everyone else. These are all, you know, it's like he could never fall in line and instead just floated along by himself. And though he was often the bane of my existence, it pains me to see him now that he has layout in the coffin. It makes me just want to > cry. Is that coffin 100% height?
Oh, man, that's funny.
So there are a number of those.
All the things about the poem that Ben was just reading are the actual literal hacks in CSS, the ways of doing things so that you can trick Internet Explorer to do what you need it to do. So,
yeah, except they've all kind of fallen by the wayside. Conditional comments, it is possible to make things very clean.
Yeah.
So,
but, you know,
cleaner.
I was reading web statistics recently about Internet traffic and whose browsers, what percentage and stuff. And one of the comments in the bot, and I don't remember what site it was on, one of the comments in the site is that these numbers are skewed. For example, an Internet Explorer 6 normally loads an extra CSS document than anybody else because the comment that everybody's ignoring, the actual fix, so therefore Internet Explorer 6 has one more hit per page in most modern websites. So the count for that, the browser count for that is going to be increased.
It's a great way of seeing how many people are using Internet Explorer.
That's true. Just look at that file. Of course, you can look at other things, too. All right, moving on. The thing is, the reason why it's deadened is not because Microsoft's not supporting it.
No,
in fact,
it's
Microsoft's
going to
support it for another 13 years or something ridiculous like that. It's because Google says they're not supporting it. So everybody's like, ooh, we can use this momentum of Google not supporting it and say it's dead, which it isn't. It's a pretty interesting. Google's pretty
powerful. It's a justification, right? Yeah, they can say, oh, Google's doing it, so we don't need to support it either because Google doesn't support it. So why should we have to support it, right?
Whatever. IE6 is dead to me. Dead to me forever.
What's going on with Google besides that, Miles?
Well, the thing is that people have been trying to get rid of IE6 for a while. You've had calls to arms, as it were, from web developers for years saying, I'm not supporting IE6 anymore, and everyone join me. And then you hear crickets.
Well, then there's the management group that says, 50% of traffic, you know, whatever the stage is at that point, we're not going to turn off that many users, so no, make it work.
Right. It's actually been a lot lower than 50%
for a while.
I agree. But where a lot of that percentage comes from is corporate users that are they have internal, you know, intranets that are dependent upon some browser technology, or it may in fact work in IE7 or IE8, but to go through all the testing takes time.
Right.
I was told by a friend of mine who works for a large company that it's at least a year, if not longer, of testing just to upgrade from IE6 to IE7. So he's going, wait, IE8 is out? Oh, man.
Right, because when you're talking about individual users, you want to have them on their task as much as possible. You have to have a group that does the work. You can't interfere with those people. So that is a whole launch process.
Right. Business-to-business applications, for example, you don't want that. You don't want to, okay, we upgraded all the browsers or half the browsers. That's even worse. And then you
find out
that...
And now you can't look at inventory at our stores anymore.
Right.
No!
Or the purchases are just off. Instead of buying 1,000 widgets, it bought 3,000.
Well, that would be pretty severe, but it's normally like not being able to access a service that your employees now need to access. So,
but many of these large businesses are becoming more and more dependent upon Google. They're outsourcing a lot of their infrastructure to things like Gmail and Google Groups and the like, and Google's making a big push to try to get Google Wave into the enterprise. And so with Google saying we're not supporting IE6 anymore, it actually starts putting a timer, you know, putting a clock on there saying we're, if we're going to have Google and we have IE6, something's got to give.
Yeah. Miles, I was kind of curious about the story that you had about Once and For All, how to leave Google. Is that something you're covering today?
Story of how to leave Google? I'm sorry.
Alan's. Never mind. Okay, and Al's not here today.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Never mind. That's why I was...
I don't want to leave Google.
Okay. We will cover that next week when Al gets back. So tell me about scaling.
Something that's very curious is that many, many applications have a bug with regard to image scaling.
Now, scaling, of course, is resizing an image, making a different size. Okay.
Now, you would think, okay, so a program has it. But I'm talking about all the software in the list, including the GIMP, Adobe Photoshop, CinePaint, Nip2, Image Magic, GQ View, I Have Gnome, Paint, Krita.
These are a big app. This is all the image editing applications.
Right.
What's the bug?
All of them, from every version, except for the preview app in OS X, had it. Except for Snow Leopard, it got fixed. So the newest version of Preview doesn't have that bug.
What's the bug?
The bug is that when it's scaling it... If you have an image that is 2,000 pixels wide and you're scaling it down to 600 pixels wide, say you're putting it up onto the web, you can't just do a clean division of pixels. Even if the image is 1,200 pixels and you're going to 600, just dividing the number of pixels by 2 is going to give you non-optimum results.
Right.
And so they do a lot of heuristics to figure out, like, oh, well, let's take these 2 pixels, let's average them out, and we'll make a new pixel in the center and do things like that. But none of these applications handled the gamma correctly. The gamma
Really?
So you had the gamma, the light and the lighting offset for that large image, and they put it to the smaller one. While they did the color pixel, the color aspects to make the new pixel, they didn't take gamma into respect.
Okay.
Gamma as in luminance or
Like monitor, the brightness of the monitor pixel? Gamma when you're actually
do you have to compensate for gamma when you're doing an image manipulation. Aren't you really looking at what that pixel's percentage of color is?
No, because gamma is a separate thing that you're saving. You ever notice when you save your PNG files, for example, it says, do you want to save gamma?
No, I get that. That's a separate... the new file's gamma should be modified. It's not that you're modifying the pixels, it's that your new image, right, the gamma profile you're applying to it, if you will, needs to be modified based off of... Why is that?
Sorry?
Why would that be? Or is it because the actual new image is... Oh, the image is a denser color, you could say?
It has a different color profile, slightly.
I'd like a better explanation than this. Maybe I will read the article. Can I get to that from geekspeak.org?
You can later today.
Delicious. All right, thanks. Let's move on. Ben, you were in at Macworld.
I was at Macworld at the Moscone Center. And I was actually really surprised. Last year, Apple had announced, hey, we're not doing it next year. We're not doing it 2010. And everyone
meaning
was like,
that Apple wasn't going to be at the Macworld.
Yeah, they weren't. Yeah, because it's not actually Apple's event. It's actually a separate company who said, hey, let's have a Mac conference. Hey, Apple, do you want to come? And Apple was like, oh, my arm's being twisted. Darn it. So, yeah, Apple was not there this year, and everyone was running around crazy like, oh, no, Macworld's dead. You know, Apple's not going to be
there.
But
it wasn't dead.
It wasn't dead. It was actually kind of fun. It was about half. It was probably 60% the size it was last year. Mm-hmm. But it was fine. It was fun. I ran around, and I saw a lot of software products, and I met a lot of people. And I want to talk about one of them, actually. It is called TuneUp. And I met the people there. It's like a couple people doing it. And it's an iTunes track renamer. And so, for example, like when I open up my iTunes library, I see it's just this mess of artists, you know, like some of the artist names will be capitalized. Some of them will be capitalized differently, you know, and things like that. And so there's no consistency across your iTunes tracks. And so what TuneUp actually does is it queries the CDDB, the CD database. Is that what? Yeah, CD database. And it sends an audio fingerprint, and then the CDDB sends back all of the metadata for the track. And then that way, you can actually figure out which songs are, you know. What's the actual capitalization of all the artists?
The same system is used when you take a CD and you copy it in or rip it into your computer and make MP3s out of it. When you do that, you'll notice the CD goes in at first, and first just says track one, track two, track three. The CDs normally don't have any information about what song title is number one. That's not part of the base protocol of an audio CD. So it just has a whole bunch of lists. Just like if you had an album record, you know, vinyl record, you wouldn't know what song was on which track without it. Different information. Yeah. So this centralized system allows the collection of data, and then you populate that information. What you're saying is that sometimes the MP3 files get mixed up. And
It depends on where you get all of your MP3s from. You know, sometimes people will rip CDs, and the CDs will have different capitalization or something like that. Yeah. Or maybe you just imported a CD and it wasn't able to query the CD-DB or something like that.
And then you name the file.
And then you either name it yourself, or it says track one, track two, track three. I had a number of those in my iTunes library, and it went through and actually fixed all of those.
Oh, how did it find those?
So what you were talking about was when you put in a CD, what it actually does is it looks at the lengths of all of those files, and it finds the album which has the similar lengths, right? So it doesn't actually look at the audio data itself or anything.
But a fingerprint of the CD.
No, because you'll notice it reads it just for a second. It just reads it for a second. It doesn't actually go through and read the tracks before it populates the data. And so that's why CD-DB can be unreliable in very specific, special cases, but usually it's pretty good. But in this case, they're actually using audio fingerprinting technology that the CD-DB has, and you have to get a special license and set up with them. So,
and let me just say, I actually don't care for CD-DB all that much.
Really? Why?
There's a free DB that's a replacement. The reason being is when CD-DB was first released, here's a nice little history lesson, they said, hey, we're going to be able to identify all your CDs. It was a free service at the time. And they were saying, hey, people, why don't you enter in the information for us? So people were volunteering their time, putting in their CDs, typing in all the track information, populating their database. And then one day CD-DB went, okay, now we're charging. But wait, we gave you all that information. We thought it was just going to be this free service. No, it's ours.
Yeah,
The
company is called Gracenote.
Yeah, and that's what launched the competitor FreeDB. Was it was saying, no, we're going to make it so that when you input all this information, it remains
free,
out there, and so that free applications, open source applications, can use them without having to get a license fee.
Yeah. Huh. So I actually didn't know that. I assume iTunes must have, or Apple must have for iTunes, a license, and then you know Windows Media Player probably has a license and all of that. In any case, I don't know. CD-DB aside, I found the actual application tune-up pretty cool. It does a couple of other things that I find really interesting as well. One is it'll actually find all of the cover art, the missing cover art for your tracks. And two, it will actually go through YouTube and find videos, so the music videos. It'll find the official music videos for the track you're listening to. And that's apparently something that the engineers just kind of threw in, you know, offhand because it was fun. And then also you can look up upcoming concert dates for the artists that you're that you're listening to.
When it's this software must do a fingerprint of the actual audio profile.
It does, yeah.
There's no more CD information on there.
Exactly. It just has a length, but of course the length can be the same as, you know, 100 other tracks out there or something like that.
Yeah.
And I found it's not 100% accurate, but I've gotten probably like 75 or 80% matching on my iTunes library, and I have a pretty big iTunes library. I've gone through about half of it.
And you got those mostly from like copying MP3 files from a large collection of having things around. It's not all ripped CDs.
Yeah. Well, some of it is ripped from CDs. Some of it was ripped from CDs when I didn't have access to the internet, so they don't have track information, you know.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting. Occasionally I just do edits to songs just for myself or humorous edits. And it's kind of funny because it actually matches sometimes. Like I had a song in Italian, an Italian version of some, I don't know, Disney song, and it actually matched it to the English version because that was what was in the CD-DB audio fingerprint database.
Yeah.
Though it was in Italian.
What I can see, I really don't think it's length of songs is the profile.
You mean for the CDs?
The CDs. I don't think it's length of songs.
I did do research on it. It is.
I'm finding that it's an ID string that every CD has.
Really?
Yeah, but I could be wrong.
Maybe.
I know that I've burned... the thing is, you're going to run into collisions relatively quickly with that, especially for singles.
Not if you're querying an entire. Oh, especially for singles. I see what you mean.
Yeah,
maybe there's a new technology that they can put onto CDs to query to ID it to a certain album or something like that. So I guess then we're unresolved on that. It could be either one.
Data structure. Data structure. The smallest, let's see, a 27-bit unique synchronization word is added so that the number of bits in a frame totals. Okay, so that's just the word for each one. So yeah. Maybe it's the actual unique bit of each track. Interesting. If you know the answer to this, how you actually profile a CD so that's unique, and I know there are collisions all the time too. Yeah. Let us know. I'd be curious. Yeah. I recall that, we'll go on to other things.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Ben, for that news story.
I should mention it's also a paid application. Right. It's not a free. They do a free trial, and I think you can do like 100 songs or something. I don't remember, but it is a pay application. But I found it.
You know, I gotta say, I've been finding a few paid applications that have been really improving my productivity, and I'm starting to like go, okay, how much is this worth my time? And I'm starting to buy stuff. Mm-hmm. I've never really been a big software buyer. I mean, a few things. I always buy the Photoshop suite because I'm a graphics guy to some degree. And there's a few applications I do, but now I'm doing like even small, like $5, $15, $20 apps every once in a while.
Yeah, me too.
If
it saves you 5 minutes a day, then that's enough, you know?
That's true. Hi, last week, Miles, you had this story, and we didn't cover it.
And the week before.
So it's totally old. This is not news.
It's not necessarily old. No. It's actually not that bad. Especially because it's something that people don't think about very often. They think you put a hard drive in, you have storage. If it's a solid-state drive, you put it in, you have storage. You have a USB drive, you plug it in, you have storage. You don't really think about how that storage is provided. You just go, oh, I have a terabyte.
Right.
Well, some things are changing behind the scenes. Western Digital has announced a change in their sector size. Hard drives aren't just, a contiguous block of 8 trillion bits.
It doesn't start in the beginning and just read all the way through like one track and a record.
Right. You have multiple platters, and those platters are subdivided into what are called sectors.
Now, a platter is actually a physical rotating thing that a head reads, kind of like an old vinyl or a CD.
Right. Now,
think
of having a piece of pizza or having a pie of pizza, and you're cutting it up into multiple pieces. And
Like slices. Slice of pizza.
And that's ending up pretty close to what it looks like from a file format standpoint onto a hard drive.
So sector is a pie shape?
Well, this is just like at the top level view. If you were looking down how it organized, it's not writing in a spiral like you would expect from a record.
Right.
It's writing in these contiguous blocks
called sectors.
It's called sectors.
Same thing about the shape. So these sectors have a size that's changing, meaning like normally a sector was a certain length and now it's going to be a different length.
Right. It was 512 bytes.
That's small.
Relatively small, but still usable. And in fact, when hard drives were setting this up, this was fairly large. Uh-huh. It actually allowed you to have fairly large hard drives. But what they're finding is if you have a hard drive and you're trying to put a whole bunch of information onto it, as they get more and more dense, you have to put in code to check for errors, mm-hmm. error checking and correcting code.
By sector.
Right. And if you're doing it every 512 bytes, that ends up being a lot of error checking and correction code, which means that they can't put as much data as they'd like on there.
Don't you also have some sort of lookup table, or is there no lookup table in this kind of thing? The head just moves from sector to sector easily? It's a hardware lookup, I guess. Not sure.
The thing is the error checking and correcting block is the same size, and the header is the same size on each item.
So every one of these blocks has a little bit of error correction, a little bit of header information on every one of these blocks. So
right.
the more blocks you have, the more meta information you're going to have about the blocks
right.
on the disk. Okay.
So what they're talking about is moving to a 4 kilobyte drive sector.
That's a lot bigger.
Which is 8 times bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And so that error checking and correcting code goes at the end of that block, and it's able to be a lot smaller than eight of them added together.
Right. Yeah. So this would allow the drive actually to have more storage capacity.
Exactly.
And this is before we even talk about formatting.
Right.
This is at the lower level than formatting.
Right. A way to think of it would be how people have complained in recent years about how they get a terabyte drive, but it's not actually a terabyte when they put it in their system. It ends up being
That has to do with formatting.
Switch between base 10 and base 2, things like that.
Right.
But that amount of space that you've lost is about the amount of space that you would gain by going to a 4K.
Again.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that if I'm selling 512 a 512-byte sector disk and it's a gig and it's a terabyte, then when I switch over to 4K sectors, then it's going to be a terabyte and a third, something like that.
You'd end up with...
Really interesting. So the 4K issue, is that going to increase speeds of the disk too, because there's less error correction, therefore the hardware's not
working? It's possible, but Western Digital isn't pushing that as a solution. And it's likely that other hard drive manufacturers are going to go to the same, do the same thing. The big issue, though, is that if you have Windows XP, you need to be careful.
Why?
Because Windows XP doesn't know anything about 4K sectors. It knows about 512-byte sectors. And
it sets itself up to succeed on a 512 system.
That, and it also has this weird offset at the beginning of the drive, where instead of going 64 bytes over, it goes 63 bytes over.
Part of the boot detection thing?
I don't know if it's part of the master boot record. It's just part of the bootloader, probably. But
When Windows formats it or sets the drive, it does it that way.
And when it does that, suddenly that 4K sector isn't aligned anymore. If you're just worried about 512 bytes, it doesn't matter. You can just align it up to be, instead of eight of them, you have one of them.
Right.
You know, lined up. But XP is off by a little bit, which means that everything after that is off by a little bit and would degrade performance dramatically. People were seeing this with some of the tools with Linux as well. One guy actually did a benchmark on it and found that it wasn't just a small difference. It wasn't like, oh, it's 10 or 20% slower, which is significant.
That's significant.
It ended up being about 200% slower.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
Ooh.
All right, well, cool. So
just by aligning it correctly. So there is a utility. So if you're getting one of these new drives, a new Western Digital drive, make sure, and if you have XP especially, it's not so much an issue on Vista and Windows 7. Make sure that you get the utility from Western Digital that will align things
which will most likely come with your drive in a CD.
Yes, really, and if it doesn't, but go and download
it. It's interesting because this is probably would affect geeks without knowing this information much more than normal, you know, average user. Because an average user goes to the store, buys an external drive or an internal drive, they get package with it, they follow the instructions of the package, which would be fine. Geeks like us go, oh, it's just a drive, let's format it and take care of it, and we'd actually be messing up. So geeks, be warned. Western Digital drives are changing. You really do need to use their utility to offset the...
geeks would have the tools already. They would use F-disk and go into advanced mode.
It's the knowledge
to
know to do that. Exactly, like, we wouldn't be concerned about it, looking into that. All right, thank you very much. Ben, you also have another app that you really like that you played with at Macworld, and we'll talk about that password app. But first, I want to let you know that you're listening to, well, Geek Speak. That's what we are. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. And at the phones in the other room is Rick. And because Rick's here to take your calls, you can call. Please do so. Ask us anything you'd like. We are willing and able to answer any technical questions you might have. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I also want to let you know that last week I mentioned doing collages with old magazines, and sure enough, I got my kids doing a little collage. And what we used is, you know how everybody seems to paint a house now and they take all the wall plates off, the PowerPoints and the switches, and you take them off because they're like this beige, and then you buy new white ones and then you have all these beige ones to throw away or something. I just handed the beige plates to the kids, gave them some glue, they slathered on cool flowers and neat stuff on them, and we put them back on the wall, and really pretty. So there's something you can do with old magazines that you can't do if you have an iPad for your magazines. So take that, Al. But he's not here to defend himself. Miles, what's going on?
Tsunami advisory is in effect today for the Monterey Bay and Big Sur Coast. At this time, wave heights are forecast to be locally up to 2 feet. Initial wave arrival is expected shortly after 1 p.m. this afternoon. Currents may be hazardous to swimmers, boats, and coastal structures and may continue for several hours after initial wave arrival. Widespread inundation is not expected for areas under this advisory. So check NWS.NOAA.gov. That's the National Weather Service, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for updates.
Thank you very much. Ben, do you have a recommendation for today? Oh, I do. That's right. Where is it? Oh, man. Did I write it down
on paper?
Should
we stall?
That's the radio announcement version of an Indian giver. Man, that's just rude.
I don't know if that's an appropriate term to use. Yes. Great podcast, or so I am told, from a friend, Earth and Environment, Colorado School of Mines. And this is an Earth and Environment podcast, and I will link to it from the website. I haven't heard it myself, but I trust the person that told me about it. So if you're interested in it, go ahead and take a look from our website. We'll have a link. And if you got podcasts that you think that the listeners of GeekSpeak would enjoy, let us know. You can do that by going to geekspeak.org and clicking on Contact Us. Of course, you can join our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter if you'd like as well. You can get that information from going to geekspeak.org, or at least the Facebook section.
Did you just say our Facebook group?
Did I say Facebook group?
You said Facebook group.
As soon as I say my face, I like my face.
They just go to myface.com/geekspeak.
You know, don't go there because I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It could be very bad.
Oh, yeah. Don't go there. Don't go there. Who knows?
MyFaceter.
MyFaceter. Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Put them together.
Also, we take on songs. If you're willing and able to write a song for a theme song plug or for the show. And of course, we also love to get images from other people to put up on our website to promote each episode. So if you get motivated to do some creativity, let us know and participate. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you want to make an image, the dimensions for the website
this week are 200 by 200. No, I'm just kidding.
So I usually
at least 400 pixels by 400 pixels, yeah, at least.
I usually do the images, and every single week, Lyle's like, oh, yeah, it's 640 by 640. And so, yeah, I make it that size. And next week, I make it 640 by 640. He's like, no, it's 600 by 600. What are you doing, Ben?
And every time you have him scaling the image and the gamma is wrong.
Yes, the gamma.
You modify the gamma wrong every time. moving on.
We are geeks.
We are waiting for calls. Oh, and if you'd like to call in, the phone number is again, 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. And that's in the 831 area code or anywhere you want to call from. If you're listening to us, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And that's a toll-free number.
Did you know that you can – I've been playing with Google Voice, Skype, all that stuff.
Sure.
And I did not know this. Apparently, you can make 800 calls for free from Skype. I didn't know this. Did you guys know that?
No, I didn't know that.
You don't have to pay. It's just it's free. So if you're calling up Apple or something like that.
Yeah, it's the company that has the 800 number that gets charged like $700 for a call. Because that's why an 800 number is free.
Call Skype up, you know, if they have a tech support. They probably don't because they're free. But
all right, so what's 1Password?
1Password, I've been using this application called 1Password. It's a paid application. But and I've been emailing back and forth with them talking about features and stuff like that. And I happened to be emailing this guy, David Chartier, who I happened to randomly run into at Macworld. And he's the chief media producer for Agile Web Solutions. And they make 1Password. So what 1Password is, it's a password manager which integrates with all of your web browsers. And I have found it to be absolutely spectacular. I mean, to the point where I don't want to use my computer without 1Password working. And the reason is that, a couple things. One, if you go to a website and you want to log in, you can just hit a keyboard shortcut and you type in your 1Password that's for your password application, mm-hmm. and it will fill in the correct password for whatever site you're on.
The password only or the whole?
The password and the login, the password.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't have to remember all of the, I mean, ideally you don't want to use 1Password across all of your social networking sites and all of your banks and all of everything.
Right.
You want to use different passwords for every single site, ideally, right?
Right, but doing that would make your brain explode.
Exactly, and my brain had been exploding for a little while and I got a little lazy, and then I found 1Password. I got it and I started using it, and now I've got different passwords for all of my sites, but I don't have to remember them because I can just hit a keyboard shortcut. It also, I mean, while there,
so you hit a keyboard shortcut and it pops up a message saying what's your 1Password, you put it in, that doesn't go to the server. What goes to the server is then a stored copy that's encrypted and everything that then is your username and
exactly
password for that site.
You type in your password, so 1Password authenticates, and then it puts in the correct password.
So the question I have for you has to do, what if you're visiting me and you don't have your laptop? How do you log into your Facebook? No, wait, your MyFace.
Well, I know. I know. MyFaceter. I know my passwords for certain sites, right? My main Gmail account where I can get my other Gmail accounts, I know that password. I know the password to Facebook. I know the password to my bank, you know, and I've got those memorized. And those are all secure passwords that I've memorized, and they're different from each other. But if I want to register with
Flickr
or like Adobe.com, if I want to download some of their Adobe Labs free software, I need to get an account with them. And so I have an account. I don't know what my password is with them, because it's actually a very secure bunch of alphanumeric and symbols and everything. Yeah. And 1Password knows it, and I don't need to. So that's
nice. And you can look it up through 1Password?
Yeah, you can look it up through 1Password. You can modify it.
How many accounts do you think you have right now? Like across, not in your password thing. I'm talking of all time, of systems that are still running. How many different accounts do you actually have? Because I go to websites sometimes now. I go, oh, this sounds interesting. And I try to log in with my email address, you know, or make an account with my email address. And I'm like, that account, that email address already exists. I'm like, but that's my email. So yeah. Then I try to get the account. I'm like, oh, I set this up 6 years ago, or whatever it is. And I'm assuming I'm in the 150 to 200 different accounts online.
Yeah. Well, on 1Password, so this is all of the accounts that I've been using in the last, I don't know, maybe...
Since Macworld?
Yeah. Actually, I got it before Macworld, but I happened to run into David at Macworld. I have 60 accounts in 1Password, about. So that means that... And so 1Password knows 60 of my passwords. And I probably have another 40 or 50.
When you drop the name David, who's David?
I just mentioned him. David Chartier, the guy I ran into at Macworld, the chief media producer.
He's one of the people that programmed the 1Password to send all the content to him once a week.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So you have he has a copy.
So he's got a copy too, just for security, safety.
Is it an open source application?
No, it's not.
Then you don't know if that's not happening.
That is technically true. But a couple other features that it has, it will save your software license keys. Again, in a secure way. So that's really nice. I actually have the software license key for 1Password stored in 1Password, which is kind of meta and funny to me. And it'll also, of course, store various things that you normally keep in your wallet, like credit card information. And assuming you trust the application to, you know, keep your data safe,
then it will take care of everything for you.
Then it literally will. You know, you can go to a site, decide, oh, I want to buy this thing. It's $5. I don't really want to fish out my wallet from, oh, I can't find my wallet. Oh, well, I don't need to find my wallet. I can just, you know.
So when you go to a site and you have your credit card information, 1Password, and you do your shortcut, will it fill in your credit card information for you?
It will.
Oh, man, that's kind of tempting.
No, but Yeah, exactly. You can right-click in the field, and you can actually have it fill in only that field as well.
Nice. I like it.
Thank you. It's fantastic. It does secure notes. You can do multiple identities.
And Ben's
in case
not
you
getting
share.
Paid for this recommendation.
I really am not. Like, it's really remarkable to me.
Here's
how
the thing. If you want Ben to promote your site, your product,
make
sure it has cool shortcuts. Yeah. Ben loves shortcuts.
I love keyboard shortcuts.
That's
what
we should have your middle name, Ben
this
Shortcut Jeff.
This is actually a nice alternative to... a single sign-on setup like Google has or OpenID because you control the actual repository.
Right.
As opposed to it just being
in the cloud.
Well,
you know,
it also holds more.
I've seen a bookmark though that's very much like this. The difference is that you're setting your password. The bookmark just does like an MD5 hash of your root password, if you were, with an addition salt of the site you're on. So you go to yahoo.com and you push, and you're about to sign in, and you put your cursor in the field that you want your password to go into, and you push this bookmarklet. And that bookmarklet prompts you for your root password, if you will, or a password. You write that in, and it takes that plus Yahoo and does some kind of hash of it. And that is then the password at Yahoo. It's kind of a cool idea.
Yeah. I should also mention, by the way,
you have to have the bookmark because you don't know the password at that point. It's a completely random, or it looks like a random string. So.
Yeah. I should also mention that 1Password is Mac only, and it's not the only one out there. I'm not saying that this is the best one or the one, but I am saying it's really, really good.
And we're not the only one out there, actually. In Seaside, there's James. Hi, James. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question today?
I've got a question about iTunes, and... you were talking about iTunes utilities earlier, and it reminded me of this problem I have with iTunes. I have a lot of CDs, full albums that I've ripped into iTunes, and then I have a lot of other individual songs that I've probably purchased from iTunes. Mm-hmm. Is there a way or a utility that I can easily find or show just the artist by, like, a full album? When I want to play a full album, I sort by an artist. But it brings up all these individual songs.
Well, there's an album selection, too.
Yeah, in iTunes, you should be able to sort by album, just like you should be able to sort by artist. If you don't have it, if you right-click on the little area where you click to sort by artist, if you right-click there, you should be able to get a drop-down of all of the different fields that you can enable, and album should be one of them.
Right, there's album by artist. But
there should also be album.
Just
album on its own, not by artist.
Right, I'm showing album artist. So that will only show me full albums.
I think we're having trouble hearing what you're saying. So what you're saying right now is you want to filter through album. When you say album through artist, I mean,
well, what I'm looking for is a way to see songs from an artist that are from a full album instead of an individual song. In other words, like, show the, like, is there a way to show only the things that have been ripped and have all the songs from one album?
I see what you're saying. Well, they're not exactly, because iTunes doesn't keep track. Like, if you only had four songs from an album, it would know that you had four. It would know that that album had four songs, but it wouldn't. It doesn't give you an interface to say that this there's missing songs in there.
Well, right. There is kind of a roundabout way that it could do it. I don't know of a way to do it, but in there it will say it's track number 11 of 17 or something like that.
Sometimes
so
it will.
Theoretically, yeah, it's sometimes, assuming that you have complete metadata, right? Which is, if you don't have complete metadata, then you can't really do this. But assuming that it does have that metadata set, then theoretically, maybe you could write an Apple script, which would go through a particular album. Maybe you can select a song, run your Apple script. It'll figure out what song you've selected, what album that's from, and then parse all of those albums. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like kind of a roundabout solution, and you kind of have to know how to Apple script.
I wouldn't be surprised if you contacted the company that makes – what's the iTunes? TuneUp? iTunes?
TuneUp, yeah.
TuneUp. I wouldn't be surprised if you contact TuneUp and said, this is what I want. They might do that because they have that information about the entire – when they clean up the system, they know – they're querying CDDB. They know how many songs are in the album. And you could theoretically just add all the complete albums if you want to a playlist.
True. Yeah, exactly.
The other thing you could do is try to – you could make a smart playlist, and then a smart playlist you could say – You might be able to do a situation where you're finding albums. You can definitely collect albums. I don't know if you can do it algorithmically, though, that say albums that have more than four songs, or give me all albums that have more than four songs, like that, which is kind of would work most of the time, if you only had one song in an album. Great question, though. That, I think, comes down to the way I would do it is I would open up a script and start writing code to do exactly that.
Another thing you could do is
response.
Search and see if there is a script already written.
How do you search for that?
Search for Apple script, iTunes scripts, and there are a couple of websites. One in particular I found, I can't remember what it's called, but it has tons and tons and tons of Apple scripts.
And tons?
And they do all kinds of crazy things that you wouldn't actually even think to do normally. And once you see the script, you think, wow, I could actually use that, so that's nice.
And using an Apple script like that, do you run into problems with new versions of iTunes and it not working?
Well, the Apple script would do, theoretically you could have an Apple script which would do something just like adding all of your complete albums to a playlist and then not actually doing anything to the tracks. It's just making a new playlist and putting all of the complete albums in there. And then from then on, if you wanted only complete albums, you could play from that playlist.
That's a great idea. Thanks for those suggestions.
Thank you for the call. Like to call in with questions and comments about technology, we're taking your calls. You can ask us anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800. It's in the 831 area code, or 1-800-655-5877.
I want to really briefly mention that we have a couple people in the Etherpad who are amazing and putting all of the links and information up of all the things that we cover. And actually, there was just a question from there. How do you right-click on a Mac? And that's a good question. I just said right-click and everything on the Mac. The answer would be you hold down Control and then you click. And that is considered right-clicking because it does the same thing as if you had a mouse plugged in and you right-clicked. So that's why oftentimes people will just say right-click or Control-click and sometimes use them interchangeably. Right-click can be understood oftentimes by Windows users and Mac users, assuming that they have an external mouse. So
yeah. Also, or, if you have
You're probably going to say the same thing.
Probably.
If you have a laptop that you've purchased in the last 3 or 4 years, if you use two fingers and tap at the same time, you get a right click.
Yeah, or if you hold down two fingers on the trackpad and then click, then that'll also do a right click. So there are a number of ways.
But the easiest is probably the Control key and then click.
Yeah, and
that's
it
one
seems
I always use.
It seems like a frustration at first, but it gets really easy. Oh, someone
I do it all the time for spelling. I was just typing something in, and I did the Control right when you said it's a frustration. I'm like, I guess it is. Oh no, I'm used to it.
DougScripts.com/iTunes. That's the website. That's up on the Etherpad, and I'll put it up on the site. But thank you to David I for finding that link and putting it up there.
All right, let's take another call because, hey, we're doing that today. Hey, from Felton, Pete, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Quite well. How are you doing?
Doing great. So I have a quick question for you. I have a Mac G5, mm-hmm. which I've had for a while now. Of course, it's loaded with software, and I want to clone the hard drive and get a bootable drive with all the software on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what you guys take is on the best way to do that. I was looking at carbon copy clone as a way to do it, but that's, if I understood it correctly, the best way is actually to not produce the clone from a drive that's booted at the time.
Yeah, you can, though. Carbon copy cloner.
Yeah, I do. That's my backup solution, is I do exactly that.
The other one's called Super Duper, which I like as well. But Carbon copy cloner will do an active booted CD disk. It will do that. The other thing you can do is, have you bought Carbon copy cloner?
It's free.
Oh, it's free.
Yeah, Super Duper.
Just wondering if you could make a bootable CD with that on it. That would be pretty sweet.
Oh, I don't know.
Because then you could boot off and run it. It would be faster if you didn't have your system running at the same time as it's running.
Yeah, that would be cloned.
Is it just to do with speed, though? Because the other thing they're saying is it's something, some difference between whether or not it makes a block copy or just a file copy, which I didn't understand.
Yeah, it's a speed thing, though. It can't do a block copy when you're modifying the files, but it can do a file copy. So it's going to look at the files, try to make a copy of it, and then and it's tricky, but it can do it. I wish there was a little better choices for that app, actually. And I think that's why I went to SuperDuper.
Which app?
For Carbon Copy Cloner.
I've actually...
Because when you do a copy, you start doing copy. I want to prep the copy with a whole bunch of content. It won't let you do that. You've got to start from root.
And this is why we need file systems that have snapshot capability.
That's right. If you had a snapshot capability, you just say, grab a snapshot. Okay, copy that.
I used SuperDuper for a long time because I wasn't satisfied with Carbon Copy Cloner. And then I downloaded it on a whim just to see what had happened with
it. The new version of Carbon Copy
Cloner. And it's really fantastic.
Oh, great. I haven't used it for a couple years.
It does almost, if not all, of what SuperDuper has done. And I'm not speaking from that much experience because I only recently kind of rediscovered it. But it looks really much better than it used to be. It's actually in active development. So
the other thing you could do, Pete, if you want to make this really easy on yourself, assuming you're going to install a new OS and everything and keep the old one, just buy a new hard drive. Pull out the drive that's in your machine, put it in a USB enclosure. Go buy a 300 gigabyte USB enclosure, right, with drive. Pull the drive out of your G5 and the container, swap them physically, and then go ahead and install a new OS on your G5. And then when you plug in that other drive, it'll work. You don't have to copy everything. Just move the physical drive out.
Wait, now what was all of that? This is why we have a podcast.
The idea is that he wants, of course, to copy all his content from one hard drive to another hard drive so that he can then boot off of that. And the original hard drive he can erase and install new stuff on. Mm-hmm. So the thought I have is, why don't you just pull that old drive out? If you buy a new drive now, it most likely will last longer than the old drive. And so pulling it out of your system and replacing your main drive with a new drive makes sense. And I recommend that in a G5 scenario. I would not recommend that in an iMac because they're impossible to open. G5s are easy as open, really fun to play with inside. So that's another suggestion, Pete, okay?
Okay. And you're saying that the difference between the file backup and the block drive backup's not enough to make any significant difference?
You're only going
to
do it once. It's just going to take a long time. Get this thing going and then... get it going in the morning, and then the next morning.
Oh, really?
It might be
okay.
Done. Yeah, it takes a long time.
Well, the other thing I thought about doing it was trying to boot the G5 up. I guess pressing T so it becomes up as an external hard drive, and then do the clone from a G4. But
I don't know if that'd be faster. And then
I'm not trying to save any time. I'm just trying to get an exact copy.
That would actually enable you to do it a lot faster. But yeah, I mean, in the sense that it's see, the thing is, now you're going through two firewall transfers. Rather than just one.
Right.
But it's not, I'm not opposed to that. The other thing is this G4 that you have, what OS is on it?
Actually, that's running 10.3.9.
Because you could theoretically boot that in target mode, boot your G5 from that version, and then copy, I think it'd be a little bit faster because the G5's firewire is a little faster. You know what? That's too confusing.
Sounds like I just try it in Carbon Copy Clone from
give it a shot first and see how it goes.
G5 while it's running and see what happens.
And then try booting off of it and see if you can do everything.
Right, okay.
Yeah, thank you for the call.
All right, cool.
Bye-bye.
And I would always recommend having two copies of your data at all times. That means that if you're reformatting one of your drives, have another drive if possible. If you can afford to have another drive, just make sure you have your data safe so one hard drive crash will not kill you.
From Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, Patricia. Patricia, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have a question regarding security. I received an email from a friend asking for a loan. She said she was in some financial difficulty. Would I agree to give her a loan? And I replied, the email said, don't try to call me on my cell because I'm in England. I came to a friend's funeral or something to that effect.
This is completely a scam, right? This is definitely not from your friend.
Of course, I went ahead and I dialed her number. But I did reply, and I said, yes, I'll give you the loan. And then I dialed her number, and I told her about it. And she says, yes, I've gotten six calls.
Yeah. But you didn't give any contact information, right?
No, of course not.
Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah,
all that you've done is confirm that the email address they have for you is correct. That's all that's happened at this point. You're basically relatively safe, just as safe as before, except for now there's a little bit of confirmation that email is good, which means that the spammer that sent that message can now put that in a different set and sell your email to somebody at a higher price because it's a confirmed email.
But,
I see.
Chances are you already had it.
It's nominal.
My name and my phone number are in the signature. But how does this happen?
Is
this something that can happen frequently to anybody?
It happens millions and millions of times a day.
Ah, okay.
Don't feel that bad.
Take your email address and tries and figures out the password.
Yeah, I mean, and here's the thing. Just assume that the internet world is a world where anybody can assume anybody else's identity perfectly. So, like, if you come in and you see a friend at a restaurant and they're like, hey, will you pay for my meal? And you're like, sure. That's fine in our society because you know that that's your friend. But just assume that there's a way to make everybody look like anybody else perfectly. Then you have to live differently. You have to not just trust people. Thank you so much for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Though Al was not here today.
Hi, this is Al Luckout here with GeekSpeak's Crazy USB Device of the Week. I think a lot of you will think this USB device is right on, especially if you're into or grew up in the 1970s. You'll think this is choice. I mean, it's dynamite. If you're jonesing for something unreal and you want to experience time warp without leaving your cube, check out the Fondue. It's the world's first desktop USB fondue set. It features an LCD display, blue LED glowing heater elements, and fire glow USB cables, just to help you feel the funk before you get down with the boogie. Can you dig it? It's a genuine fondue pot, signed, sealed, and delivered, except you can only really melt chocolate and a few cheeses. It's possible when the new USB 3.0 spec comes out, you'll be able to drop things in boiling oil right next to your keyboard. But the fool that you are, you may want to get out your hot pants and boogie on over to geekspeak.org and check out this link. Well, keep on trucking and good night, John boy.
GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. Classes now forming for January. UAT.edu/masters. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence. He's used with permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. For GeekSpeak and KOSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.